for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. U.S. and Pakistani officials are trying to confirm reports that a CIA missile strike killed the Taliban leader in Pakistan on Wednesday. Joy and new questions about the release of two U.S. journalists from North Korea, and amid ongoing unrest, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was sworn in as president of Iran for a second term on Wednesday. Joining me for this international hour, the Friday News Roundup, Nancy Youssef. She's Pentagon reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal magazine, and Susan Glasser, she's executive editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Nancy Youssef, tell us what we know or don't know about this Taliban leader who has been said to have been killed.
That's right. There was a predator strike on his father-in-law's house on Wednesday, and the initial reports are that his wife was killed, and we're starting to hear now from Pakistan's foreign minister and even reportedly from some Taliban commanders that Masood himself was killed. It's a huge blow for the Taliban leadership in Pakistan. It's one of the biggest gets, if you will, that's happened in Pakistan. Masood was believed to be responsible for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto in 2007 and for the Marriott bombing in September of 2008. And so this is a big hit, not only for the United States, but for Pakistan as well, as he's been seen as someone who has targeted and killed a lot of Pakistanis. He was believed to have as many as 20,000 fighters and to have killed as many as 2,000 Pakistanis.
James Kitfield.
I think what's fascinating about this is we've seen earlier this year, there is reports that we Predator strike killed bin Laden's son, and there is maybe 14 pretty senior al-Qaeda lieutenants have been killed by these predator strikes in the last 12 to 16 months. What I find fascinating is, you know, even though they're very controversial, and we've known for quite a while the Pakistanis have given it kind of a wink. They rail against it domestically, and that sort of plays very popular with the domestic audience. But they've clearly started to cooperate with intelligence much closer with us, because getting these guys, Masood would be obviously the biggest get, but getting the guys, you can constantly see they're targeting higher and higher up the food chain of al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So that's very significant. And Masood's very significant because he did something that scared the Americans a lot, which is instead of sort of focusing on Afghanistan, which the Taliban had been focused on, he focused on destabilizing Pakistan. And I think we said in this program a while back, when Pakistan launched that attack against SWAT, you know, finally did the counterattack, finally got serious about the threat, it was either a tipping point or a turning point. This suggests that it was a turning point in our cooperation with Pakistani intelligence.
Susan Glasser.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you're making. Remember, it was just a few months ago that Time magazine named Baitulla Masood as one of the 100 most influential individuals in the world, arguably because of this role in destabilizing Pakistan. The flip side is, I think it puts renewed attention on the stepped up, the really escalated program of drone attacks inside Pakistan. And although there have been, you know, marked additional success in targeting senior-level al-Qaeda and Taliban figures over the last few months, it's come at a fairly significant cost in terms of civilian casualties and in terms of internal destabilization of Pakistan.
James Kitfield, you mentioned closer cooperation between U.S. intelligence forces and those in Pakistan. Does this possibly indicate we could be closer to finding Osama bin Laden?
Oh, I definitely think it does. I mean, if you get his son, you know that you're somewhere on the trail. His son had been in Iran for quite a while, but decided to go back to the tribal areas where we assume that bin Laden is. So you got to believe he's closer to, you know, somewhere along the trail of his father. And Masood would, like I said, second only to bin Laden and Zawahiri, the top two of al-Qaeda. Masood is public enemy number one. So to get him shows that they are very close to the inner circle. Now, I don't know, we don't know whether there was direct contacts between Al-Qaeda
right.
and Massoud, but we know they were aligned. They had announced their sort of alliance. Another thing that scared us about him, he somehow managed to sort of unify a conglomerate of warlords and insurgents under the Pakistan Taliban umbrella and focus it, again, on destabilizing the Pakistani government that, of course, has a nuclear arsenal. So that was a big warning light, and to get him would be a significant victory.
And also, I think it signifies that Pakistan sees a mutual threat, that the United States and Pakistan share a same enemy, which has not been the sentiment for a very long time. And I think moving forward, one of the things we're watching for, I think, is not just how President Zardari reacts, but also how the Pakistani army reacts. They had gone into Swat, but were hesitant to go into South Waziristan because of Massoud, because of his influence there. And I think moving forward, as a military correspondent, I'm watching to see if the Pakistani army now has more confidence to go into Waziristan, and whether that's a good thing, given what happened in Swat and the refugee problem that came out of that.
So what implications might there be for the U.S. in Afghanistan?
Well, of course, the timing of this is really significant, I think, because it's just a couple weeks before the Afghan presidential elections, of course, first of all. Second of all, there's clearly been, a heightened campaign in the south and the east of Afghanistan, where the Taliban has concentrated its resources. Nancy is just back from there. I'm eager to hear her report from it. But I think the timing is significant. Will this cause a renewed Taliban focus on the other side of the border in Afghanistan? There's already significant concerns about what percentage of the Afghan population is really in a position to be able to participate in this presidential vote. As much as 40% of the country, I believe, is rated a security no-go zone. And so I think we will see some spillover effect.
James.
Well, I also want to hear what Nancy has from the ground. But one thing that happened this week that was very significant was that Secretary of Defense Gates and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Admiral Mullen went to Europe and met with the Chief General in Afghanistan, Stanley McChrystal. And McChrystal is putting together this report, basically, that's going to outline his strategy. There's a lot of his advisors who have now talking in Washington in the past week about what that report will entail. And everyone says that it's worse than they anticipated. And McChrystal is surprised at how bad things are and how bad they've been allowed to slip over the last few years. We've seen just a steady drumbeat of casualties, not only our own service members, but also allied service members. One thing that report will have is a plus-up of Afghan security forces from roughly 150,000 to 170,000 to 400,000, which is a huge undertaking. It's going to require a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of money. And there's going to be an increase from McChrystal for more troops. Now, General Jones, the National Security Advisor, is kind of trying to push back against that because Obama's not ready to go there yet. But it's clear that they think they need more troops, more resources, significantly more Afghan troops trained.
You know, it's funny, when you're in Afghanistan, you feel that even though we're in year eight of this war, it feels like starting over. The review of the basic questions about what the goals are, what the strategy is, what the tactics are. James was talking about this proposal of doubling the number of Afghan security forces, which sounds great, but where do you get 400,000 people, and how do you pay for them? At the number now that they've put forth, 134,000 Afghan troops, another 85,000 police, that's at about $4 billion a year in a country that generates $800 million in total revenue. And so how do you put together this force, and can it really do it? You get the sense, and I spent some time with a lot of the coalition countries, they are exhausted, they're politically exhausted, and going forward, this will increasingly become America's war, because we've the opportunity cost of sort of holding on while Iraq was going on has been a coalition that's exhausted politically, militarily. The British lost 8 soldiers in a 24-hour time period. The Canadians were planning to pull out at the end of 2011. And so on the ground, it feels like even though there's not marked change in what's happening, there's a feeling that it's starting over and that this time they have about a year to turn things around before the political clock here starts ticking.
And, of course, that was sort of what President Obama said. We'll give it a year.
Right.
And then reevaluate.
If I could just, on that point and on the point that Nancy makes, where do you pay for these troops? Well, I was in Afghanistan last fall and talked to the guy who was training the Afghan security forces, and he made the point, which I think is very, very pertinent, which is to keep one American division there for 1 year costs $12 billion. We can field probably 5 times that number of Afghan forces for the same amount of money. Wouldn't it be better to be spending our money to have the Afghans do this rather than have our troops doing it? So that's number one. There is a problem of getting officers, though. They don't have trained officers. You've got, you know, right. you can recruit a lot of people because it's a very poor country, but you can't recruit experience, and they don't have a lot of officer-type experience, especially at the senior levels. Two, I think that we do have about a year, and they're trying to, I think, with this new strategy, sort of in this fall, before the winter comes and the fighting season ends, to have some models, some places where they have cleared, held, and started to rebuild, so they can point to those successes and say, if you give us more troops, we can do that for more of the country. And next spring and next summer will be, again, I think, they think, the linchpin of whether this is going to be a success or a failure.
Well, I think one of the questions this naturally raises is how exportable is the Iraq model? And, you know, I think one of the things the Americans are finding is that it's not as exportable as they'd like it to be. Remember that when you talk about the turnaround in Iraq, you look a little bit at the sort of resurrection of Iraqi police, Iraqi military. Well, you were really talking about converting an existing military, an existing police force in Afghanistan after three decades of war, you know, and a warlord-type system. You're not looking at something that can easily be reactivated as opposed to created from scratch. So it's not only the financial burden and who's going to bear that, but I think you're seeing right here the question of how much can we import our knowledge and thinking from the Iraq experience.
I just want to add a couple of points to that. You know, this idea of how much it costs, it's true that it costs a lot to keep an American division there, but we're talking about supply. In an economic recession, telling the American public that the United States and its coalition partners are going to pay for the Afghan security forces indefinitely. And I think that's a hard argument to make.
Nancy Youssef, she's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Susan Glasser, she's executive editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup this week with Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We've just had a caller say that no one seems to recognize if we cut the war, we can cut the debt. It's totally unnecessary. Nancy.
You know, it is a good point, and you can't help but notice when you're in Afghanistan, you look at the coalition countries, how much the United States is spending there relative to these other countries. But the problem is, what's the cost of leaving and leaving it in this state? There's a cost to that, too. I want to kind of give you a sense. I was in Kandahar, which is not only the most important province, but it's historically where the Taliban came from. It's now being patrolled by 2,800 Canadians. About 700 of them actually crossed the wire. In Sangasar, where Mullah Omar founded the Taliban, there's not one coalition soldier. Outside the base, in the week that I was there, three attacks right outside the base, a message clearly to the people that the Taliban's in charge, not this coalition. And you talk to the population, and they are so jaded. You know, people will say, are they for the Taliban or are they for the coalition? They're for being left alone. They're they've lost faith in what the coalition can do. And this is the circumstances that Stanley McChrystal finds himself coming into in Afghanistan. And this is Kandahar. This is the most important province in Afghanistan, and it holds the most important city.
Susan.
Well, you know, I think the Kandahar factor is a really significant one. There's a terrific piece in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine profile of Hamid Karzai. And one of the incredible quotes in this piece, which I really suggest is required reading for understanding what's happening now, is a quote from Hamid Karzai's brother, who's an accused, you know, of being involved in all sorts of nefarious activities in Kandahar. And he said to his brother, the president, although arguably with very limited ability, he said, you know, I'm just screwing up Kandahar. You're screwing up the whole country. Telling.
Wow. All right, let's move on to North Korea. Tell us about Bill Clinton's trip there.
Well, wasn't it fascinating, diplomatic and political theater, to see the former president go to North Korea? You know, it was interesting for us who've followed this a long time. He was planning on going to at the end of his tenure as president. Madeleine Albright went to North Korea and met with the senior leadership, sort of paving the way for a final deal. In the end, there were some stumbling blocks, and Clinton focused more on the Middle East peace process, so he never made it. So this is kind of the trip that that was foretold 8 years ago or so. But, you know, a picture speaks a thousand words. And when you saw him sitting next to Kim Jong-il, he couldn't have looked unhappier. And, you know, clearly the North Koreans played this like a state visit. They wanted to sort of wring every bit of propaganda out of it. You know, they don't get very many opportunities to put their leaders on a world stage with world leaders, even former world leaders. So that was a big propaganda coup for them. You know, weighed against that, you have a humanitarian. We got the two, part of this where we got the two journalists back. That was important. And I also think, you know, in the next month, you're likely to see a diplomatic channel reopen. We'll see. Clinton's supposed to meet with Obama today. They're debriefing. They took a couple of Korean hands, one who spoke Korean on the trip with him. You know, this has been at a stalemate since May when they detonated another nuclear weapon. They're looking for some way to get North Korea back to the talk, to the six-party talks, without having to give anything. And they're holding out these sanctions. They toughened up the sanctions a couple months ago. So I think that if you see a diplomatic channel open up in the next month, something good might have actually come from this trip. But in the short term, clearly, North Korea reaped the propaganda bonanza out of this.
Interesting, Susan, that one of the two journalists that was held captive said that after her release, she said she had very briefly crossed into communist country.
Well, that's right. I saw the account, I guess, her sister provided where she said it was literally for 1 minute, it was accidentally.
30 seconds, something like that.
The sentence is 12 years. But, you know, I guess this is the real interesting question. How much of a propaganda victory do you think that the North Korea thing was? And there's been a real lively debate here in Washington this week about that. John Bolton, famously opinionated senior Bush administration official, was immediately jumped out, wrote a piece that was widely circulated, arguing, that in effect that the Obama administration had played into Kim's hands. You know, I guess I'm a little sanguine about that. And to what extent do we really think that, releasing two journalists who were sentenced to 12 years in the gulag constitutes a propaganda victory? But remember another state visit, not Madeleine Albright's, but when Jimmy Carter went to meet with Kim Jong-il's father. 7 weeks later, of course, was when his father died, and we had the last version of a North Korea succession scenario. And already there have been increasing reports. Obviously, Kim looked extremely frail in those pictures. There have been reports coming out of North Korea over the last several months that he has tapped a successor, his unlikely third son, who's very young.
27, something like that.
Exactly. So, you know, that may already well be underway. And rather than a new phase of engagement, right, you know, what we actually could, you know, end up with sometime over the next year could be a kind of turmoil that we don't understand. So it will be interesting in Bill Clinton's debriefings with President Obama, with senior Obama administration officials, what his readout was. I believe it's 3.5 hours they
exactly.
spent together.
Exactly. Long time. Yeah. Now, isn't it true that, or it's been reported, that the North Korean leadership is not very happy with the selection of the 27-year-old son, because that would indeed be creating kind of a dynasty.
That's right. And, you know, just as an amusing footnote, and all those photos, who was in that photo but Clinton's personal doctor? And he wasn't just there to check on the state of the journalist, but as much as one can by looking at someone, I think, get some sense of Kim Jong-il's health because of this very issue about who's going to take over. And because we know so little, he, of course, suffered a stroke last year, and the Western world knows very little about his health. And I couldn't help but be a little amused that in all those photos, never far behind was President Clinton's personal doctor.
It's interesting that those two young women worked for Al Gore's news organization, and yet it was not Al Gore that apparently was asked for, but former President Bill Clinton.
Well, that's right. I believe they proposed Al Gore, and it was the North Koreans who vetoed it, which is interesting.
Yeah, why take the vice president when you can get the president?
especially when you're kind of in an argument with his wife, who's the Secretary of State, and they've been a lot of really hot rhetoric between her and the North Koreans in the last couple of weeks. So to them, it was probably irresistible to try to get the president there.
Robert Gibbs, the White House spokesman, told reporters on Air Force One on the way to Indiana that the two, President Obama and former President Clinton, had talked for a few minutes right before President Obama went out to speak with the press about his reaction to the journalist being released. The president thanked him for a great job, knew how much the families would appreciate what he had done, but clearly the full debriefing has not yet taken place.
And you know, it's interesting. It's funny to me that we haven't heard any leaks about what the president's learned or what came out of the strip. And it's very possible that he learned very little about their nuclear program. And perhaps one of the reasons we haven't heard about a long debrief is that there isn't much to debrief on. The White House was very explicit about saying that this was not a negotiation.
A personal mission.
That's right. That this wasn't about the nuclear weapons issue at all, and that this wasn't any sort of deal made in return for anything. And I think what will be interesting is whether we haven't heard anything because they've kept it very tight or because he didn't learn that much.
It's interesting that the North Korean nuclear negotiator met Clinton on the tarmac. So mm-hmm. I think those talks had went beyond just the humanitarian discussion of these two journalists. And I would guess pretty strongly that there was significant information that they're going to debrief Clinton on, and he's just being smart. He's holding his powder because he wants to talk to the president.
Exactly.
But we very rarely get a peek inside behind this curtain. It is not called the Hermit Kingdom for nothing. We know very little about what goes on there. So putting Bill Clinton and a couple of really senior, John Podesta and a senior Korean hand from the State Department in proximity to them to talk to them for hours and hours is probably the best glimpse we've had for quite a while.
Yeah, I think that's a key point. It's clearly, in that sense, an intelligence mission. It also was clear that the Obama administration was highly involved. This wasn't just a purely personal thing where he hopped on a private plane and went there.
Well, that is the question. Yeah. How much support was there from the White House?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there have been reports, which I think are credible, that they were highly involved. Senior officials were involved in the negotiations about, you know, making sure, for example, they had received assurances that Clinton would be successful, that he would get the journalists. He wasn't going to take off in that plane and risk not coming back with them. So that back channel had already been established. And I believe that some of the significant conversations through channels with the North Koreans were occurring at almost exactly the same time that they were publicly attacking Hillary Clinton. You'll remember their memorable comments on the sidelines of the recent summit, where they called her alternating between a prim schoolgirl and other such ad hominem attacks.
But so there were, and I have no reason not to believe it, reports that Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor, was directly involved, not only in reaching out to Clinton when he heard that the North Koreans wanted him to come, but also in reaching out to the North Korean delegation at the United Nations and saying, if he comes, we want these journalists out and we want assurances that will happen. And he got them.
Exactly.
And yet I can't ignore the sort of lack of enthusiasm in terms of where this advances the nuclear weapons discussion. I mean, you don't feel in Washington that people are hopeful. It's a very sort of wait-and-see approach. You'll sort of hear people say, don't hold your breath. We don't think this is going to lead to major changes.
Don't forget that President Obama is somebody who doesn't show a great deal to the public unless there is reason to.
But I think this is more about, this is a reclusive regime that the United States knows very little about because it was so cloaked in sort of propaganda and a way for Kim Jong-il to sort of have the national stage that I think it's very hard to know. And because the United States, frankly, has done a very poor job in sort of predicting, as most have, in terms of what North Korea is going to do and its intentions are. So I think they're trying to sort of lower expectations that, yes, this is a wonderful thing that these journalists release, but that doesn't mean that this will lead to an advance in terms of the nuclear weapons discussion. And I think they're trying to temper expectations.
Let's talk about Iran and the fact that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was sworn in for a second term yesterday amid continuing, however small, protests going on outside. Is this kind of unsettled situation likely to continue, Susan?
Well, it does appear that although the Iranian election has not triggered a full-scale revolution, it has triggered a new and very unstable state inside Iran. There appears to be a continuing fairly high-level power struggle that we don't have a very clear read on, but it clearly has continued. If you look at the normal patterns of behavior inside the Iranian political elite, although Ahmadinejad has been inaugurated again, some of the things that we would have expected to occur as part of that haven't, likely signaling, continued conflict. At the upper ranks, there is this show trial, which has been a really, I think, dramatic signal of a regime that is very uncertain about its own prognosis.
And talk about the people who were put on trial.
Well, really, what's extraordinary is there was more than 100 defendants seated basically in an auditorium-like setting. There were so many of them, and it amounts arguably to a who's who of the Iranian political and journalistic intelligentsia. Any remaining sources of what the regime would perceive to be opposition, whether they had anything actual to do with the recent protests or not, it's not at all clear. They have academics there and scholars, in addition to political activist types. They have journalists. Of course, there's a correspondent for Newsweek magazine and for others as well. So, it's a real who's who of Iranian thinkers.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. James Kitfield, do you expect that unrest to continue?
I do expect it to continue for a while. And my fear is, and I know it's the fear of a lot of people in the U.S. government, is that this will be, once he is now sworn in, he's made some pretty veiled references that he's going to lead a crackdown. And you look for, if there's arrest of the leading opposition figure like Mousavi or the former reformist President Khatami or Rostan Fani, the people now who are sort of the clerics who are standing outside and sort of against this election. And if they start arresting those guys, then it really is going to signal a significant crackdown. It's going to complicate our relationship dramatically.
And what about the three Americans who were arrested for apparently crossing the border from Iraq into Iran, Nancy?
That's right. These are three hikers in Iraq in Kurdistan who somehow crossed the border and were arrested, we learned this week. And again, it's a question of what their fate is and what kind of...
But they were warned. That's what bothers me. They were warned by Iraqis that they were getting close to the border.
Can we put out an all points bulletin now? Please, American hikers, don't go into the Kurdistan Mountains near the border with Iran, because it's not helpful. It's not helpful to you, and it's not helpful to our diplomacy with Iran.
And it's not helpful to Iraq, which is so trying to change its image and say that this is a place that you can come to and this is a safe place, and trying to revamp its image. This does not help it.
So what happens next? Is there some ongoing communication, Susan?
Well, I think unlike in dealing with North Korea, yeah, there is a much more established, track record of Americans being able to engage with Iran through back channels. Europeans, of course, several countries actually have relations with Iran. So, there's a much more filled out relationship that's ongoing even in times of stress than with North Korea, for example. One question, and I didn't see what the follow-up was. I think these hikers actually were still being kept in Iranian Kurdistan, which probably bodes well for their fate. If they're trucked all the way to Tehran and
I
then
see.
They're put on trial as spies or that sort of thing, that's going to you might need another President Clinton mission, you know, at that point to get them out. If it remains at that level, I think, you know, you're dealing with something once the Iranians verify these do indeed seem to appear to be semi-clueless students who were language students in the region in Syria, at least a couple of them were. So perhaps it can still be handled at the level of clueless interlopers.
Now, history suggests they'll use them as pawns in whatever diplomatic game they decide to play with us and eventually let them go, hopefully. What I will say about is interesting to me right now is that the clocks that are ticking on the Iran issue are kind of out of sync. Obama has set for next month as a deadline for Iran to respond to his offer of engagement. You know, a lot of people are saying we should have a tactical pause because you don't want to be engaging with a regime that's lost significant legitimacy because of these elections. On the other hand, the Israelis, who are trying to sort of push into a peace negotiations, are saying you have got to put a deadline on your dealings with Iran and your sanctions because we think they're going to get the bomb sometime in the next year to 16 months. So it's very difficult right now. I mean, this problem, these internal problems with Iran, although interesting, have really sort of skewed the diplomatic schedule that Obama had sort of set for Iran, and it's difficult to know exactly how you sort of put it back in sync.
James Kitfield of National Journal. When we come back, we'll open the phones and we'll also talk about Russian submarines.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Bud Schulberg, who wrote the screenplay for On the Waterfront. He died Wednesday at the age of 95. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film, Julie and Julia, and we listen back to our interview with Julia Child. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And it's time to open the phones. Your questions, comments for today's international panel, James Kitfield of National Journal, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, first to Urbana, Illinois. Good morning, Paul.
Thank you. I wanted to talk about Honduras, but I'll talk about Afghanistan because I was prompted to. But I did want to make a forward. I know you're very good about when you have a guest on about telling their connections. But I have a particular bête noir, and that's Moises from Foreign Policy. I think you really should mention that he is from he's a former minister in a admittedly by himself corrupt Venezuelan government. Now, on Afghanistan, I understand Kekulin has just issued a report. He was an advisor, Australian fellow, young man, to the media. He's been very critical of the drone policy, the Predator and Hellfire missile attacks. Now, there's one success that's apparently being claimed. But he's really close to it, and he is a real warrior, which I don't share with him at all. I think, but he even says that these predator attacks have so many civilian casualties, collateral damage, that they're really not helping the this announced project of bringing the population over.
All right, James Kitfield.
Well, he puts his finger on which has been a very hot debate within the military, which is everyone understands there is a blowback from these predator strikes. There are frequently some civilians killed. You're going at people's houses, after all, who work. You know, these insurgents kind of operate from these sort of safe houses around. So there is blowback. On the other hand, the other side of the argument is we have no other tool to put pressure on al-Qaeda and its affiliates in the tribal areas. And if you surrender your one tool, then you're basically surrendering any way to put pressure on them, to keep them worried about their movements, to keep them worried about their communications, et cetera. The signs of it's not just Massoud. Again, they killed bin Laden's son recently. They've killed 14 pretty senior al-Qaeda lieutenants in the last year and a half. They are not going to give this tool up. But what they have done is working with the Pakistanis much more closely to try to limit the cases where there might be collateral damage and civilian casualties. And they've reflected that even more so in Afghanistan, where on airstrikes now they've implemented a much tougher policy, to the point where some tactical commanders are complaining that it puts their soldiers more at risk. But they're trying very hard to have it both ways, to retain this one tool to put pressure on al-Qaeda, but at the same time to limit to whatever degree possible the civilian casualties. And he's right. Kilcullen is on the side that says it's just not worth it, the blowback's too much. But there are a lot of very senior people, and I suspect McChrystal is amongst them, who says we can't surrender our one tool.
Susan.
Well, it is true, though, that General Petraeus, when he was in Iraq, was a really significant proponent of counterinsurgency doctrine that would hold that this escalating campaign of attacks from the sky has rained down more trouble on the U.S. policy in both Pakistan and Afghanistan than it might be worth in terms of the tactical gains against al-Qaeda commanders. So I think that debate might reflect the more limited toolkit of options that the U.S. military finds itself with in the region.
What was the reference to Moises?
Well, that's a good question. The caller clearly has a point of view or an axe to grind. I'm not quite sure. Moises was long ago an official in a Venezuelan government. He has worked for many years as the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine.
All right. We'll leave it at that. Let's go to Muskegon, Michigan. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you, Ms. Rehm, and your show is so important.
Thank you.
Wondering from your panel if in their networks or research they've found any discussion about the idea that, you know, people will say we created the Taliban during the Russian occupation, and is there any discussion going on about the future of us giving arms to everyone?
You know, the discussion you hear more than anything is maybe what needs to happen is that the United States starts negotiating with the Taliban, and because this idea of working with Hamid Karzai and a centralized government hasn't worked as well as people hoped. You hear now talk about decentralization and bottom-up reconciliation, but there's a risk to that because you end up electing potentially warlords, and I think privately, quietly, people are talking about what sort of negotiation might need to happen with the Taliban down the road. Remember that in a lot of parts of Afghanistan where we consider them no-go zones, they have shadow governments, shadow court systems, and I think quietly that's the real discussion. I think one you'll start to hear down the road.
Susan.
Well, you know, this has, again, been talked about in terms of applying the Iraqi playbook to Afghanistan. And the key being, can you find a government of national reconciliation? What segments of the Taliban are there as an ideological matter? How opportunistic is it? Are there commanders? Are there regions that you can flip in the way that the transition in Anbar province in Iraq was seen as a model for how you might achieve more national stability in Iraq. However, and I think this is a key, however, this model arguably applies much better to a country that's had a short-term shock in the way that Iraq did rather than 30 years of war.
Just a quick point. You know, the only people we're arming in Afghanistan is the Afghan security forces. We're not arming militias. In fact, some U.S. Commanders have requested we try to repeat the Anbar model, give these guys some tactical, you know, rifles and stuff to be our local militia, and they were turned down. So we're not right now arming any militias in Afghanistan.
James, tell me how we're doing with Iraq after the U.S. troop withdrawal from cities and towns.
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag, but I tell you, there's a lot of concern on the American side that you know, we have Iraqi elections coming up for the prime minister next January, and there's a lot of concern that Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki, is really doing a lot of things to rush sort of putting Americans in the background because it plays really well politically. He's removing all the blast barriers from Baghdad, and I can tell you there's a lot of concern that will lead to a renewal of these suicide bombs in marketplaces, and those barriers do a couple of things for you. They keep the blast contained, but they also make it hard for the bombers to escape. They make it hard and they make it easy for people to regulate who comes through into the main parts of the city. So it'll be great if it works and there's not a whole lot of violence, but there's concern that will lead to violence. There's concern also that he's taken all American checkpoints out of the green zone. He's basically the green zone is now all policed by the Iraqis themselves. And the Americans are pretty much confined to their embassy within the Green Zone.
And tensions with the Kurds, Nancy?
That's right. He went up to Kurdistan, met with Barzani, who just won his re-election there, in this effort to reach out and deal with what the Americans say are the most divisive issues and the most long-term issues facing Iraq. What to do with Kurdistan, the autonomous region there, what to do with Kirkuk, the distribution of oil revenues. These are critical issues that, frankly, I think most people don't think can be resolved by the time the U.S. troops withdraw by the end of 2011. And I think there's an effort and pressure on Maliki to get started on that now, because this is something that will take years and years and years to resolve. If I can just go back to the blast wells, because I lived in Iraq and in Baghdad when those blast wells went up, and it was really painful to watch. I mean, you almost cried at the sight of it, because it was such a sign of defeat. Mm. When you went everywhere you went, in the middle of areas where people prayed, these huge 20-foot-high blast wells, and it was one of the most depressing times in Iraq to see them go up. And so I think James is absolutely right. I think Maliki's taken a lot of political risk, but I think those symbolize defeat and violence in Iraq in a way that most things didn't, in terms of people's day-to-day life.
But are you concerned?
Of course. 37 Shiites were killed today in Mosul and in Karbala. I mean, the cost of that is extremely high. I just want to point out the political cost of those blast walls. They are tremendous.
All right. To Spokane, Washington, Rakesh, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is sort of heretic, never discussed about, and that is, I'd like your journalists, if possible, to comment, to contrast the difference between North Korea and Pakistan with respect to nuclear weapons and United States interests. Now, let me just elaborate on what I'm asking for. Now, here is Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons. It is a state where terrorists are running amok, from Al-Qaeda to Taliban to India-specific terrorists. It's a nuclear-armed country. We're having so many deaths. Al-Qaeda launched attack on the United States from their bases there. But yet, we seem to be obsessed about ridding North Korea of its nuclear weapons, and we give Pakistan the status of a nuclear-armed ally of the United States.
All right, Susan Glasser.
Well, I think the caller's accent perhaps is his emphasis in this conversation is a little bit off. You know, Pakistan is widely considered in Washington by senior policymakers, people who had long experience in the region, to arguably the most dangerous country in the world right now for many of the reasons that the caller very smartly articulated. It's a nuclear-armed state with terrorists, running amok, challenging both the government and the U.S. president, destabilizing the region. There's a long list, and I think a pretty broad consensus, that Pakistan right now is the center, rightly so, of U.S. Engagement in the world, looking at the long list of threats. North Korea is a very much an exception to how we look at ongoing things. Its unique status as the hermit kingdom, its extraordinary network of gulag concentration camps, all of those things make North Korea a subject arguably of great fascination. But I would think in any reasonable calculation of the ongoing strategic threats to the United States, interests of the world, certainly to regional instability, to the prospect of a major nuclear event, Pakistan is number one, two, and three right now.
Could somebody explain to me why two Russian attack submarines have been cruising the Atlantic off the east coast of the U.S., James?
You think they want a summer vacation, maybe?
Martha's Vineyard.
This is part of a trend we've seen for the last couple of years, and it started like this. We kept expanding NATO right up to NATO, to Russia's borders, and they were very upset about that. We invited Georgia and Ukraine to consider themselves as key candidates to join NATO. They were very upset about that. We announced that we were going to build a missile defense system in Eastern Europe, in the Czech Republic and Poland. Very upset about that. To sort of counter that, they have for the last 2 years been, you know, running their bombers, their nuclear-capable bombers, close to NATO airspace. They have been making ship visits with warships to Cuba and Venezuela. So this is just a continuation of that. They were fairly flush with oil money until recently and allowed them to spend more money doing these kinds of things. For a decade, the Russian military got out of the business of doing these kind of global sort of patrols. They want to get back into it as a show that we're back as players on the world stage. But the U.S. military does not take this as an alarming thing at all. These are Russian attack subs. They are not the missile-carrying, nuclear-capable missile firers like our own ICBM subs, like our own Tridents. These are attack subs that really can only their armament really is focused on attacking other submarines. So it's not a huge threat. I don't think the American military takes it as any kind of an alarmist trend.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Kevin.
Hi, when we violate Pakistan's sovereignty and they complain about it, are they doing it with a silent nod of us? And also, a very popular right-wing website announced that there was a truce offer between either the Taliban and us or Al-Qaeda and us. Do you have a comment on that? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling, James.
The truce offer was from Al-Qaeda, and it repeats an offer they made a couple years ago, which is if you remove all your forces from Muslim lands, you know, we'll stop fighting you. So it's a non-starter. It's not serious. And no one's willing to negotiate with Al-Qaeda. We can negotiate with factions of the Taliban to try to break that off because they're local fighters fighting, you know, local concerns. Al-Qaeda has launched a global assault on us, and we're not going to negotiate with Al-Qaeda, for starters.
And to his first point, is there sort of a tacit understanding? Yes, there is. I mean, privately, I don't think they have to sort of, that publicly you have to sort of raise objections because it's just so offensive to the Pakistani people. You cannot survive politically in Pakistan and allow this to go on, particularly when there are accusations of civilian casualties. But privately, these are forces that are a threat to Pakistan's sovereignty and security as well. And so that's the push-pull that's going on when it comes to those predator strikes.
I was just going to say that it's also leaked out that a lot of those predators take off and land in Pakistan.
That's
from
right.
Bases
and
in Pakistan.
To Ocala, Florida. Good morning, Ron. Ron, are you there? Okay. Let's try Jackson, Mississippi, and Brian.
Yes. My question is, in Afghanistan, as the recent book Horse Soldiers points out, the special forces were extremely successful there. It's the cheapest way and most effective way to wage war in this type of a situation. Why don't we use them as they're intended to be used and like was so successful in the early days?
Susan.
Well, I'm curious what the caller means about our lack of use of the special forces. Clearly, Afghanistan's terrain is almost like the training ground for special forces. He's referring probably to 2001 when the CIA and special forces units went into northern Afghanistan. They rode horses very famously across miles and miles of terrain. That was part of the campaign that ended in Mazar-i-Sharif falling. Clearly this is a country in which unconventional warfare of every kind. There's no possibility for a pitched battle on a plane, in Afghanistan today. All of the tactics being used, as Nancy, I'm sure, has seen, are in one way or another a reflection of those kind of special tactics.
Yeah. And remember, General McChrystal is a former Special Forces commander. And, you know, the argument that goes on in the military is that the U.S. Army and Marines, in some cases, are becoming more Special Forces-like because of this very kind of warfare that they're fighting.
What does that mean exactly?
That instead of sort of rolling up with tanks and battle lines, that you've now got soldiers walking, patrolling, meeting with locals, gathering intelligence, sort of acting in some cases as kind of a local warlord themselves and trying to contain communities because there's such disorganization, settling disputes, mitigating the violence there. So for example, in some parts, the tanks actually antagonize people because they destroy property. The things that we would have used in the Cold War literally can work against the United States military in this kind of battle.
Just a quick point that, the listener is referring to two different phases of war. We found out in that phase of war, which those things are very useful in when you're fighting formations of Taliban who are actually holding territory. When you're fighting a counterinsurgency where you don't see your enemy, he pops up, he hits you, he goes away, that's not so useful.
James Kitfield, National Journal, Nancy Youssef, McClatchy Newspapers, Susan Glasser, Foreign Policy Magazine. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.